I'm curious, do you have a really great BS detector? Maybe you're often skeptical of others. Are you really street smart? Would you say you're pretty self-assured? You often find yourself being the leader in the group. Maybe you even struggle to ask for help. Do you love a good challenge? Do you fight really hard for the causes you believe in? Do you have a great sense of humor? I bet you're a blast. You might have thought that these were all parts of your personality, but they might actually be coping mechanisms you've picked up over the course of your life, and they're having a huge impact on how you show up, especially on this motherhood journey. Are you curious to know more? You got to take my personality patterns quiz. Here's what's going on. When you were a child, whenever an experience overwhelmed your nervous system, you subconsciously built a defense against that overwhelm. Over time, those defenses became a habit, and then they became a pattern. And now as an adult, what we think of as our personality is often this defense pattern running the show. It's so interesting, right? There are 5 different personality patterns, and they're not personality types like the Enneagram or the Myers-Briggs, but rather they describe the safety strategies that we immediately go to when we start to feel overwhelmed. They don't describe who we are so much as what's blocking who we are. The good news is that once you take my quiz and learn about your pattern, you can learn skills to break out of that pattern, and then you can live and parent your kids as your true and authentic self. Click on the quiz link in the show notes or go to michellegrosser.com/quiz now to take my 2-minute personality pattern quiz. Welcome to the Calm Mom Podcast, the show for ambitious women ready to get off the hot mess express. I know you've got a lot going on. You work so hard. You're raising an incredible family. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. I'm your host, Michelle Grosser. I'm a certified master life coach, attorney, wife, and mom. And years ago, I was right where you are. I was running a busy law practice while raising a family, and I was on the fast track to burnout. I thought I just needed to be more organized or have better routines, but it was learning how to heal and regulate my nervous system that expanded my capacity to gracefully hold more of this big, beautiful life. You too are worthy of an extraordinary life in and beyond motherhood. Learning to be a calm, anchoring presence in your home and at work is going to be your superpower. If you're here to do the inner work that brings a sense of calm amidst the chaos, I'm here to join you on that journey. Each time you press play, your growth continues. So let's get at it. Hey friends, Michelle here. I am so delighted to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Arleo to the show today. She is a professor of radiology at Cornell Medical College, and she's the attending radiologist at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And she's also the author of her book, First Eat Your Frog and Other Pearls for Professional Working Moms. We talk in this episode about our mental health. We talk about the ways in which moms are diagnosed with depression and anxiety and how that has jumped, especially moms that are working while raising kids. And it's not surprising, right? Considering the amount of stress that working moms have faced for decades. So when I talked to Dr. Arleo in this episode, she really shares tips and strategies for us, for working moms, that we can leverage to overcome our challenges and manage the overwhelm that we experience and really improve our happiness both in and out of the workplace. Some of the things that we talk about in this episode are why working moms are more vulnerable to overwhelm, the kind of stressors that working moms are managing. We talk about imposter syndrome. We talk about how to tackle the time that we have and use it well. And then one of my favorite things that we talk about is our need to stop over-apologizing as a gender. I think that's something that we tend to do. We apologize for everything. And Dr. Arleo and I get curious about why that might be, and we talk about it. So enjoy this conversation with Dr. Arleo. Dr. Arleo, welcome to the Calm Mom Podcast. I'm so grateful that you've taken the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Please call me Elizabeth.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. As we jump into, we were just talking before we hit record, you wrote a book We're going to talk about it today, but a lot of the same things that you teach on are the things that we really focus on as our core pillars here on the podcast. So this is such an awesome connection that we've made, and I'm so grateful that our audience is going to get to hear from you today. Before we jump into it, would you tell our people who you are, what you're doing, and kind of the work that you've been doing lately, especially in this realm of motherhood and overwhelm and the mental load and all of the things?
Yes. Hello to all the people listening. Thank you again for having me. I'm Elizabeth Arleo. I'm a mother of three. I am a professor of radiology at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, where I practice breast and body imaging. And most recently, in March of last year, I published my first book, First Eat Your Frog and Other Pearls for Professional Working Mothers. And we have a Labrador.
As an aside, and we have a Labrador. That's awesome, because I just let my two dogs, my husband's not here today. Usually he's home during the day. So I have been like at my desk and then up letting the dogs out, then up letting them in, then up letting them out. It's that never ending. You know how it is. It's
that's
awesome.
What I was doing. So I was like, better not forget to mention Lupa the lab. So who knows what she's doing at her off hours.
That's right. Okay. So let's talk about it. I think a good place to start might be just with overwhelm in general. I think as moms, as working moms, as professional moms, we can have these unrealistic expectations for what we can handle and do. And I think there can be a lot of shame around feeling overwhelmed sometimes, or even why we're feeling overwhelmed, because we really care about a lot of things and we really manage a lot of things. So I would love for you to just talk about that generally. Where are you seeing women feeling overwhelmed? How far reaching is this? Because I think when people hear from you about overwhelm, it will help them feel less alone.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's both a good and a bad time to be a professional working mother. I think like the good news is that, you know, many or most of us here grew up being told, many of us, that, you know, we can do anything we want to do. We can be anything we want to be. You know, we can become a doctor or a writer or a host or run for higher office. And yet the bad news is that, you know, in conjunction with motherhood, I think our culture is just not really set up to support this. So, you know, politically, there's no family federal law ensuring paid family medical leave. Economically, high quality child care and elder care, for that matter, as well, is hard to come by. You know, and at work, women are still working that double line where it's like, if you don't speak up about your achievements, then you may be passed over for a promotion. And yet if you do speak up to, you know, and you're thought to be too loud or aggressive or assertive, then, you know, you're dismissed for other reasons. So, you know, even if you're lucky enough to have the most supportive partner at home, it's still a double or triple whammy to manage career, motherhood, and yourself. And all of these components contribute to the overwhelm you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I've probably, like yourself, raising three kids and being a doctor and a professor now, I've experienced so many seasons of overwhelm, and I've had to continually reassess the boundaries, right, that I have in place and my priorities, and also just really being honest with myself about what my capacity is and not feeling bad about that, because it's okay to have a bandwidth as a human being, right? It's not something that's bad, but learning how to honor that before we reach burnout. Absolutely. Or whatever it is really important. Okay, so I want to talk about your book, First Eat the Frog. Before we jump into it, tell the people listening, what does that title mean? Because I think I know the story about eating the frog, but I want you to explain it to everyone before we jump in.
Okay. So First Eat Your Frog comes from a quotation attributed to Mark Twain, who said, if it's your job to eat a frog, it's best to eat it first thing in the morning. And if it's your job to eat two frogs, it's best to eat the larger one first. And I've had this quotation hanging in my office wall for years now, because it reminds me to do the most important thing as early as possible in the day, week, or month, you know, whatever time period I'm dealing with. And, you know, how does that help us as professional working mothers? I think, you know, twofold. One, you know, it sets yourself up for success. Like, come what may, the most important thing has been taken care of. You know, and two, it also lessens your mental load. Instead of like worrying about having to take care of whatever it is, you're taking care of it and you can, speaking of bandwidth, like devote that mental energy to the other gajillion things you need and want to do.
Yeah, so good. So I want to talk about it. You have 8 lessons in that book, and I'd love to kind of touch on them. Before we do, as you were sharing that, I was just kind of curious, what prompted the book? Like, were you just kind of seeing over and over again the same thing? Was it your own experience? Was it all of it? Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, it was written during the pandemic, during a time where, you know, clinical volumes in radiology dipped as non-essential screening studies were unable to be performed. And in academic medicine, we were all, you know, rethinking how can we best add value and contribute to our institutions. And being in an academic center, teaching is always part of what I do. And I really ramped up the teaching because I could just give lectures via Zoom. I spoke to people in Kenya. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity. So without getting on the plane. So I started doing increasing number of lectures, and especially about talking with women in medicine, women coming in the pipeline. And finally, you know, we're all working in a small area. My oldest daughter, who was 12 at the time, she said, you know, you really should write a book. Uh-huh. And I said, what would it be about? And she said, you know, everything you've learned since you had me, because she kept hearing, and I thought about it, and you know, no matter what the audience is, I'm still coming back to these same 8 pearls, these real fundamentals, and I'm wondering if I could reach. I think they're applicable, you know, beyond medicine to professional working women, and really of people of any genders, and yet. I'm a woman and this is what I know. So I'm just going to speak to this audience.
Huh. Perfect. So good. Okay. So let's get into it because I know everyone wants to hear. So the first one was to eat your frog. We kind of touched on that already, getting that big thing out of the way first thing in the morning before the kids and the schedule and all the things can come in and interrupt it. And that frees up so much mental space. And then regardless of what happens after that, right, by the end of the day, it's like, okay, at least I got that done. Yeah.
Before we move on, can I do a public service announcement that demonstrates this frog?
Yeah.
Okay, because I specialize in women's imaging. So the recommendation of the American College of Radiology and Society of Breast Imaging is for women of average risk to get annual screening mammography starting at 40 and continuing for as long as the woman is in good health. I'm over 40 now, so I'm in that, you know, cohort. And yet screening can be anxiety provoking for all women, including myself. So I like to eat my frog by trying to schedule my annual screening mammogram as early as possible in the month, week, and day that I'm having it done. So I can set myself up for success by taking care of myself physically and not have that mental load of worrying about it the whole time.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for that, because that's a good reminder to a lot of women listening. And it is, right? It applies there and it applies to so many other things. And I think you make a good point too. This isn't just like that big project that you're working on at work or this phone call you have to make that you've been avoiding. We can prioritize taking care of ourselves in these ways too. Like make that, if that's a frog, like make that a frog and get that done. Because a lot of times as professional moms, we come last. So I love that idea or that shift of like, hey, we can make ourselves a frog and take care of ourselves first thing in the day, and then also take care of everything else that comes our way after. So good.
Absolutely. It's like, you know, being on an airline and they say, make sure to fasten your oxygen mask before you take care of the child next to you. And you have to take care of yourself before you can take care of anyone else, of your children, of your spouse, of your patients, of your community. It has to.
Right. And really being a mouthpiece and encouraging women that's not selfish. That's not greedy. That's not like, let's shift how we think about that, because it is, I couldn't agree with you more. Okay. So eat your frog. And then number 2 says 168 hours. You have more time than you think. Tell me about that.
Yes. This is an idea I first learned about from Laura Vanderkam, who is a writer and a speaker, and a mother of 5. Wow. And she delineated this idea. And it's that it's helpful to think about time in terms of 168 instead of 24-hour chunks, because the fact of the math is we all have the same, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which equals 168 hours a week. And so even if you, you know, work 50 hours a week, which is more than many people, and you sleep 56 hours a week, which would be, 8 hours a night, 7 days a week. That sounds like absolutely delicious to most professional working women. Then the equation still is that you still have 62 hours after work and sleep for yourself, for your relationships, and for your community. So when you think about time, how does this help us as professional working mothers? You know, I think it really lessens the pressure to your tagline about, you know, trying to lessen anxiety, overwhelm, and burnout. And I think it thinking about time in 168 hours does that, helps in those areas, because you seeing all this white space on your calendar, it's not that you can't do everything, but if you take the time to be clear and intentional about your priorities, there is time to take care of your priorities in those 62 hours we still have after work and sleep. And I think that's just lessens the pressure to know that.
Yeah, it sure does. It sounds like a lot of time, and it's encouraging. It is a lot of time. So tell me, I'm just curious, in your research and into talking with women about your book, where do you find that most of that time is going? Like, I feel like there's a lot of people listening who are going to be really surprised when they think about it. It's like, wow, 62 hours, that's a ton of time. For people who are shocked by that, where is that time usually going that we can like take back some of it and use it more intentionally?
Yes. Well, another good point Laura Van Kamp makes is like, if you don't track your time, you do not know exactly where it's going. So she and many others are big advocates for time tracking. I like to think about blocking out sort of like an ideal week, not like sitting on a desert island with cocktails in my favorite book. That sounds great. But just like what takes into account all my responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And plan where my time goes. That I find very helpful. And you know what? I would put that widget on your phone and see how much time. I think that's going to be the number one time suck. The amount of time we're actually, you know, spending on our screens. And if you like data like I do as a physician scientist, then you could see like literally where your minutes are going into all the different, you know, buckets. Was it productive in that I was doing I don't know what, or was it not productive? And yeah, so I think you have to know where your time is going and where you want to spend your time, and try to marry the two to find the best balance. This is not in any way saying there shouldn't be downtime. There has to be downtime for relax and recharge. And that can be intentional time that you use in those 62 hours.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think when we're intentional about our rest and recharge time, to ensuring that we are actually resting and recharging. Because a lot of times when we are scrolling or on our phones, we're just dissociating or disconnecting or whatever, and it's not actually life-giving. So I love that you make that distinction. And I feel like that segues perfectly into your point three, which is if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. And you talk about kind of blocking off your time and being intentional about choosing where it goes instead of it just slipping away. But talk to me a little bit about planning and maybe some other areas in which you've seen a high ROI for working moms.
So that quotation, you see, I'm big on quotations in books, comes from Benjamin Franklin, said, if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. And I think that most of us don't set out to, you know, plan to fail. It's just that we're running around putting out fires at home and at work, and you need to, you know, have that, you need to have a meta, like planned to plan.
Yeah.
Time to plan. To
yes.
Plan.
Layers here.
Exactly. And that it sounds ridiculous, or like, you know, you're running a military operation when you're just, you know, not just when you are doing the most important job, taking care of your family and any other work you may do. And so I think taking the time to plan is really important. And I'll say, given a long interest in like time management and organization, which I feel like has just increased every time I've had another child, and I'm done now, we have three. So there are other ways that I will choose to increase my efficiency, but I have I've read different books, and I will tell you that my top three resources, are as follows, and I've used them for many years. And what I noticed during the pandemic, and when I was talking about them, is that like they have the flexibility. They had the flexibility also to take me through, you know, a global pandemic and still keep me, you know, going. So I have no financial connections to these, but in no particular order. Number one, in terms of methodology, Getting Things Done by David Allen. This is an oldie but a goodie book that really rests on the premise that the mind is for having ideas, not for holding it. And that's sort of like a bottom-up approach. Number two, if you're a little bit old-fashioned like me and still like your paper and pen, I do full focus planner. Yes.
That's Michael Hyatt's planner, right? The full
focus. Exactly. Michael Hyatt's planner. They're quarterly planners. And this is more of a top-down approach in that it starts with delineating your 10-ish annual goals across different domains of life, like circling back to your point about, you know, self-care can and should be one of those, because you can't take care of all the other goals if you're not taking care of yourself. And then breaking it down to focus on no more than two or three goals per quarter, which then trickles down to your, you know, weekly and daily goals. And then the third little to no cost is the app Todoist, which I use to try to like tie it all in together. So number one, getting things done. Number two, full focus planner. Number three, Todoist. Those are my top three resource recommendations that have worked for me over many years and situations.
Oh, I love all of that. And we'll link that all in the show notes for you guys if you want to start trying these out and dabbling and getting yourselves planning, right? Really just planning. So I think a lot of times we feel overwhelmed. And then when we just get it down on paper, it's like, okay, I can actually have a plan now. Just that is like so comforting to our nervous system. So absolutely. I'll put those there for you guys. So good. Okay. So number four, you have remembering the pre-meeting meeting. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I first learned about the pre-meeting meeting from a mentor of mine, Dr. Sherry Cannon, who's the chair of radiology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And she was giving a lecture at one of our annual meetings in 2018. And she talked about the fact that how, you know, men, if there's an important or controversial issue, men have pre-meeting meetings. Like, and they just beforehand, they chat, they know their talking points, they know how, you know, people are going to vote, and then they go into the meeting and it happens. Whereas women, you know, think that they do like copious research and they come into the meetings and they, you know, present a very balanced view and want to have dialogue and discourse, and then think there's going to be, you know, a balanced vote. But the fact of the matter is, men have pre-meeting meetings and women should too. And for me, this was an absolute game changer. I'd never heard anyone just spell it out like this before. And I can tell you it has been essential part of what I have done in working to improve paid family medical leave in radiology and beyond, at taking a step-by-step approach at every step of the way, numerous pre-meeting meetings to really, you know, refine points of views, understands, you know, concerns and potential rebuttals. It's not that by having pre-meeting meetings, you will convince everyone of your position, but in doing so, you're really socializing the issue at hand, creating a respectful discourse, and in the end, hopefully being able to address as many voices as possible.
Mm. Okay. So tell me more about how this looks on a practical level.
Yeah. I just actually did a video, a podcast or whatever it's called, for the American College of Radiology on the pre-meeting meeting. Like, it's a dedicated 15 minutes about it, because like the process, for example, of the pre-meeting meeting for getting a resolution passed at the American College of Radiology is really like a year process in terms of, if you really break it down step by step. So I think the important thing to focus on is that especially if there's an important issue where the outcome is going to make a difference for you or a constituency, or it's controversial in some ways, just like we, you know, do a research for meetings, it can be helpful to meet with major stakeholders beforehand, to share your point of view, to ask, you know, for questions and objections. And if they support you, great. Are they willing to stand up and endorse you at a meeting? And, you know, if not, what are their concerns and how could you potentially address it? And I think, you know, in terms of planning planning for success. This doesn't always ensure success, but I think it really maximizes your chance of doing so. And whatever you work in, there's probably a lot of politics involved, and in whatever area it is, medicine or politics or otherwise. And so I think that this is a really, really valuable pearl that I learned from Dr. Cannon.
Yeah, it's great leadership. And I'm even, as I'm hearing you talk about it, I'm thinking about ways that I could incorporate that even in the nucleus of my family, right? Like going to my kids individually and talking to them and hearing all the sides and then all coming together. Those are pre-meeting meetings, right?
I love that. You're absolutely right. Genius.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So that's so good. Number five, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This is one of my favorite things to talk on. Last week here on the podcast, I launched a private podcast about burnout, 5 episodes. I had the idea. I sat down, my parents had my kids, and one day I recorded all 5 episodes. I made a landing page and I released it because I knew it was good and there was a need for it. People were asking for it and it wasn't perfect. And I still know it wasn't perfect 2 weeks later, and I haven't had the bandwidth to go back and fix all the little things, but it's out there and it's helping people. And I want you to talk about this because all of us have things that need to be out there before they're perfect. But it's hard and it's scary and it's vulnerable. So talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this idea, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, is a quotation attributed to Voltaire, who was a French philosopher in the 1700s. And I do not have this quotation hanging in my office because, as a recovering perfectionist in the area of clinical care, like taking care of my patients is the one area that I mm-hmm. still strive as close to as humanly possible for perfection. As possible. Yeah. But in other non-clinical areas, as a recovering perfectionist, I strive more instead to be like a satisficer. In other words, if there's a task or a project, I try to set criteria, and those criteria or the bar can be quite high, right? Yeah. And yet once those criteria are met, I try to be, you know, satisfied and done and move on because, you know, say, for example, I'm like looking for a restaurant for date night with my husband. Okay, what's the criteria? Good Mexican food with a good happy hour within like a 1 mile radius. Once I find that, I, you know, book it and I'm done, because there is no perfect restaurant out there, right? And it's not the highest and the best use of my time to be endlessly scrolling through the internet looking for that perfect restaurant, because the perfect doesn't exist.
Yes. I'm like writing this down when you said it's not the highest and best use of my time, because I was going to ask you, as a fellow recovering perfectionist, it's easier said than done, right? Like, I know in my head that I got to let this stuff go and I can't continue to fixate on it. But it's, I think, a practice in growing our capacity to be uncomfortable in all of the what ifs, or not experiencing everything, or not having all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed. So I wonder if you could even just comment on that a little bit, like the practice of just being uncomfortable with letting stuff go, because it can be really uncomfortable in the beginning and that can be okay.
Absolutely. You know, I think that how does don't let the perfect be the enemy of good help us? I think it's that, you know, it's important to remind ourselves that perfection is not humanly attainable, because yeah. Striving for something that's not obtainable just contributes to feelings of, as your tagline says, anxiety, you know, depression, feelings of overwhelm and burnout. And so I think of all the lessons in my book, Don't Let the Perfect Be the Enemy of the Good is the one I self-talk to myself most frequently.
Yeah.
And it's okay to talk to yourself in dialogue. And, you know, I think the first thing to do if you're a recovering perfectionist is to, you know, recognize when you're going down the rabbit hole. Yeah. Of perfection, take a step back and say, you know, what are reasonable criteria? Have I met them? And if yes, then I move on. And I think it's really important, not only for one's own mental health, but also, you know, for modeling for our children.
Yes. 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 I love all of that. The next one I'm really excited to talk about too, because your number 6 is to stop over apologizing, and kind of how we describe ourselves as recovering perfectionist. I would also probably describe myself as a recovering over apologizer.
Right. Just like bumping into someone and over apologizing, or every time I was late by a minute because I had, you know, two babies at home and diapers throwing up or something, and just really changing my mindset around that. But talk to us about it.
Yes. So this is a pearl that I learned about from a mentor of mine, Dr. Hedy Riesack, almost a decade and a half ago. She, until last year, was the chair of radiology at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And she talked about, you know, she had been chair for many years, and she noticed that people would come into her office and ask for things, you know, for a raise or more money or flexibility or lab space. She said she noticed that women would just start for no reason at all by apologizing. Mm. And, you know, to define over apologizing is not only apologizing too frequently, but also when it's not indicated.
Right.
You know, this can be a real, really hurtful to us as professional working mothers, both professionally and personally, but just focusing on the professional, because, you know, it comes off as a weakness, and it almost like primes the person you're asking something from to say no. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the first step is, again, you know, watch your mouth, listen to yourself. Yes. And those around you, like when you get off this podcast, just, you know, for as long as it's in your brain, like listen to how many times you say, I'm sorry, or the people around you, particularly women, say, I'm sorry. It is appalling. And once you notice it, if you feel strongly about it, like I and we do, you're going to want to do a better job.
Yeah.
For yourself, and again, modeling for children, especially girls.
Yes, exactly. And there's so much wrapped up in that. I was like thinking, I was going to ask you, where does that even stem from? Because it's so prevalent in women, but, you know, probably centuries of garbage put upon us. So I can only imagine. But what it does is it really shifts our autonomy also, because I think that when we show up, right, and we're saying, I'm sorry, before anything else, there's not a power struggle, but like there's a shift in the power dynamic there. And for me, if that's something that you notice that you say a lot as you're listening, and you're like, oh, wow, now I have this awareness that I do this, and I'm curious about how I can go about changing it. Something that's helped for me, and Elizabeth, I'd love to hear in your experience what's helped you, is that I've shifted, instead of saying I'm sorry, to try to pattern myself to say thank you. So yes. If I'm late, right? Okay. So tell us about that. Is that's an effective shift that seems to really help?
Yeah, no, tell me. So if you're late, instead of saying, you know, sorry to keep you waiting, thank you for waiting for me. Or, you know,
sorry, it took me so long to get back to you. Thanks. Right. Thanks for your patience as I got back to you, or whatever it was.
Yes. It is a totally positive mental reframe. And it's kind of fun, because at first you feel like, how can I possibly switch the sentence around? And you don't feel like you can. And then you see that, yes, you can.
You can. Yeah. And none of us are like, yes, apologies, asking for forgiveness, forgiving others. These are all really important things, but save them for when they're actually like to be used, right? So many times when we are apologizing, like you said, it's just not necessary. So checking ourselves and being like, hey, is an apology actually warranted here? If it is, go for it. And if it's not, how can we shift this to what we're actually trying to say? Because we're not going out of our way to hurt anybody in any of these situations, but we're so programmed to apologize. And there's something deeper going on under the surface there, if you take a look at it, I think. Yeah. Do I have you back?
Absolutely. But I think obviously it's a great interpersonal and also professional strength to be able to, you know, recognize when you've made a mistake or been wrong and say, I'm sorry. This is a great strength, both professionally and personally, of course. And yet over apologizing, you know, presents as a weakness, both professionally and personally. And it could really behoove us as professional working mothers to try to stop over apologizing.
That's right.
Or less so.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Number seven, this kind of, I think segues too. The way you like line this up is so beautiful. It doesn't hurt to ask politely without apologizing that you're asking, right?
Yeah, you put the two together, and it seems like maybe I'm this Emily post with respect to manners, but not at all. It's just more this. I'll tell you how this lesson came. This is not from, you know, the highest echelons of academia or radiology, but this was a lesson I really learned from my daughter, Sophia, when she was maybe five or so. And she She loves lychees, which I don't think I had a lychee till I was an adult, but it was for a while that you could only get them in Manhattan, where I'm based, like at the end of May around Memorial Day. And so it was mid to late May around Sophia's birthday, and we're walking along. I remember very specifically on 86th Street heading towards the East River. And she kept asking, you know, the fruit stand, excuse me, do you have any lychees? No, excuse me, do you have any lychees? And I said, you know, after all, sweetie, I think they're just not here yet. Let's check next week. And she was insistent. And I think we were practically in the East River, and she was rewarded with, yes, how many pounds would you like? And she turned to me and said, see, it doesn't hurt to ask. She didn't put in the politely at that point. Yeah.
Great.
And she, you know, we learn so much from our children in so many ways. The politely I add on, and I feel a little bit sad about having to add the politely on. But again, this goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, where there's this very like fine tightrope that women are walking at work. And I think, you know, even maybe there's some women who are stronger and braver than me. I'm sure there are and or will be in the next generation. But sometimes just the ask is so big, like that's just so big and can be really, really hard. And so tacking on politely, you know, which means with respect and courtesy, just makes it so that, you know, even if the answer is no, like you've done it in a respectful, courteous way, it's hard to object to asking politely.
That's right.
And it reminds you, like, if you don't ask, the answer is going to be no, you're not going to get any lychees. But if you do ask, the answer may be no, but you might be rewarded with yes.
That's right. You don't know if you don't ask. So as you're talking to professional women on this podcast, what do you want to encourage them to ask for?
Ooh, that's a great question. That's the question that they should ask themselves.
Yeah.
You know, if presented with an opportunity that you think you might like, and yet you feel really torn about how to make it work, stop. This is not an emergency. There's no immediate answer. Stop and think, what would make it worthwhile for me to take this opportunity? You know, I would do this if I could, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And think about, set the bar high, set the criteria high, and ask for it. And, you know, it may be a negotiation, but if you get even one more thing, yeah. That is important to you, maybe more flexibility with work. That, you know, I think, you know, the silver lining of the pandemic is that it's really opened up, you know, it's not, you know, where and when you get work done, but what is the work? What is the criteria for work? And if you're meeting those criteria, you know, in some industries, it doesn't, you know, it could be flexible, could be home, could be on non-traditional business hours.
Yeah, so good. I think that's true. We need to be reminded that we can ask for these things. And I think again, too, and I'm just speaking of this anecdotally, I don't have the research to support it, but I also think that's probably a thing we see different in the genders, that I think men are very hesitant. Are very quick to just ask for what they want without any big explanation or rationale for it or any apology for it. You know, these are going to be my hours. Is that okay? Or whatever it is that they're going to ask for. And I think there's something that we can learn in that from the men in our lives.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Number 8, have a growth mindset. What a beautiful place to end it today. Talk to us about what a growth mindset looks like and how it can really be a superpower for us.
Yes, I love that, talking about a growth mindset as a superpower, because I really think it is or could be. So the term comes from Carol Dweck, who is a psychologist who wrote a book called Mindset. And it talks about what it refers to is an individual's perception that their abilities can be developed through hard mm-hmm. work and a commitment to learning, as opposed to, or in contradistinction to, a fixed mindset, which is that, you know, you believe your basic qualities are fixed. And, you know, I think I didn't learn about this growth mindset until, again, my oldest daughter, Sophia, was the one with the lychees, was in third grade. And she came home with this, I mean, you see it now I see it around, but this growth versus fixed mindset piece of paper with two heads facing each other and the definition of growth mindset and fixed mindset. And she was supposed to hang it on her bulletin board to remember to have a growth mindset. And I like quickly copied it and put it in my office as well, because I thought it was so, so very important. And I think, you know, it can be hard to have a growth mindset because, like, you have to with all these things that we're talking about, like over apologizing and, for example, you have to recognize it before you can do better. Yeah. And so you don't know that you have a fixed mindset unless you realize that you do. So again, I think one of the themes that we're talking about in all of this is just the importance of self-awareness.
Yes. So we talk so much about self-awareness here on the podcast, and the listeners are probably sick of me saying it, but I always say that awareness precedes choice. And we cannot intervene in a world that we can't see. And those are two things when it comes to awareness that I'm always, especially when we do this internal work or the self-discovery work, because that's the foundation for all of it. So I just love that you've given our listeners so many new levels of awareness in each of these eight categories or eight lessons. And I'll link the book, First Eat Your Frog, in the show notes for you guys too, so you can pick up your copy. Elizabeth, tell us where we can find it. Tell us where we can find and connect and hear more from you.
Thank you so much. You know, the book is available on Amazon.com and bookshop.org. And I also had the great pleasure of audio recording the book. So if you're a busy professional working mother, you can listen to the Audible version while you're exercising or folding laundry or commuting or whatever. Yeah. And I'm on LinkedIn, which is a big professional site, as well as you can find me on X or Twitter, also big in the radiology community, at Dr. Arleo, and similarly on Instagram.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I know our listeners did too, because I know them and I know they're so into this stuff. So I'm excited. I'm going to order a copy of your book today. I'm excited to read it and share it with my people. But thanks for making time for us today and for being here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Great conversation.
If you love Mommy's Podcast, leave a review.
If you enjoyed this episode, it would be so awesome if you could take a moment to subscribe and rate the podcast. And if you have just a few more seconds to leave a quick review, they really help to get this podcast out to other moms like you. I read every last review, and trust me, when it's late at night or early in the morning before my kids get up and I'm working on bringing you all of this content, your reviews are what keep me going. Leaving a review is truly the best way you can thank me. And of course, DM me on Instagram. I love to hear from you. Thanks for listening to another episode. Head over to the show notes for this episode and all past episodes at michellegrosser.com, where you'll find free resources and more ways to connect with me. If you love the show, share it with a friend. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next time.